entertainer, and entrepreneur answered the call. He joined forces with friend, businessman, and scholar, Christopher Hart. They teamed with lifelong radio pro Nostradamus. Together, they are guardians of liberty and the American way.
Ladies and gentlemen, introducing the champions of political professional wrestling, Larry Adams, Nostradamus, and Christopher Hart. The American Adversaries, Drive Time.
Welcome to the land of reality. In a world of plugged-in zombies, the American Adversaries Drive Time on, yes, you know it, News Talk 660 WORL. I'm Lair Adams, and it is so good to be with you. Talk about a conundrum. Well, the Democrats act like they're doing everything they can to lose the next election. And the Republicans are working as hard as they can not to win it. Welcome to high school politics, where no one wants to be the winner. My co-host was head of the class. The class that couldn't wait for freedom, Christopher Hart!
Oh, there you go. Amen to that. Thank you so very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Lair Adams, for that great introduction, lead into tonight's show. And once again, folks, you are listening to the American Adversaries. It is Drive Time, and we are live. 407-774-8255 is the number if you'd like to participate in tonight's show. And Lair and I are going to start the show off. We have John Wohlstetter, who's going to join us in the next segment. He is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, and he's also the author of Sleepwalking with the Bomb. So we're going to talk a little bit about Iran and the nuclear weapon. Also, a little bit about the stop and frisk policy up in New York. That's a very big issue in the campaign up there when they can talk about something besides Anthony Weiner. And then we're also going to talk to him about the embassy closings, the terrorist threat in Benghazi. There's some new news out of Benghazi that if you've been listening to the American Adversaries for a while, you've already heard this. But this is now breaking as news. You remember when this whole Benghazi thing started to go down in terms of the scandal last year? Mm-hmm. We couldn't find out what was going on. And come to find out that somewhere along the line, somebody had given the stand down order and who did it. And basically, we said that it was the three-headed president, if you were.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that President Obama, and I believe we had an author that we talked about this mm-hmm. with, that President Obama doesn't make his own decisions, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's two other people in his life that help him along, if you will.
Yes.
One is, of course, Michelle.
Yes.
And the other is?
Valerie Jarrett.
Old Val.
Yeah.
Old Val's in the news. And as a matter of fact, we even poked fun at Mr. President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
By calling him Barack Obama, Obama Jarrett. You remember that?
Yes, okay.
Obama, Obama Jarrett,
yeah.
I was calling him.
Uh-huh.
We were calling him for a while because Obama, too, and
yep.
Val Jarrett are really the ones who pull his strings, right,
yep.
so to speak. And there's a story today breaking that Valerie Jarrett is the one who at least, if not made the decision, delivered the decision, because I guess Barack Obama was preoccupied doing something else. He was too busy to take care of it on his own.
He had a campaign.
Something. Yeah, that's right. He had that big event the next day.
He had a campaign, Chris.
Yeah, so we'll be talking about
that. Was obviously more important.
We'll be talking about that later on in the show with John Wohlstetter and Nostradamus when he joins us. Once again, folks, if you want to be a step ahead or a few steps ahead or a few months ahead or maybe even almost a year ahead, just listen to the American Adversaries. And while we're on that subject, you know, there I was this morning, once again, minding my own business, and I'm reading in the Wall Street Journal, which is one of my favorite publications, along with Investors Business Daily, And here's this article by Michael Medved. Now, of course, you folks know who Michael Medved is, right? He's on for 2 hours before our show.
Absolutely.
From 3 to 5 o'clock, live from Seattle. And when I compare our show to Michael Medved's, I like to say that his is a bit more cerebral,
yes,
shall we say.
That's a good way to put it, Chris.
But nonetheless, every now and then, whether he knows it or not, he finds himself in agreement with us.
Sure.
Now, one of the themes to our show is, of course, the name, The American Adversaries. And if you've never heard our explanation before, let me just sort of summarize it by saying we have an adversarial form of government. That's why we have a show named The American Adversaries. We're not adversaries per se with one another, Lair and I.
Or America.
That's right. But we are all American adversaries because we are participants in an adversarial form of government. And then the wrestling connection, which you hear in our bumps and in our language sometimes, is because we liken politics to professional wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I have to say Barack Obama is so successful is he understands that connection.
Sure.
Now, he may not see it in that terminology and that light, but he nonetheless understands the way it works. Okay? And the best wrestlers, quote unquote, who rise all the way to the top,
sure,
are not just the ones who can get out there and beat the
or
other guy.
Or have the big muscles.
It's the guy who can get in the ring and do what they call work the crowd.
Sure.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Anytime you want to watch the WWE, pretty much the first thing they do is they come out and they work the crowd. Sometimes they'll open up with a match right away, but usually one of the wrestlers or a group of them come out and with a microphone. They stand there for 15 minutes working the crowd. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Getting them mad or getting them happy or whatever the mood may be of the day.
Mm-hmm.
All right? The politicians that do this very well also rise to the top.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Barack Obama does very well. If you watch any of his speeches, now granted, he has a sympathetic audience, but he works the crowd very well.
Oh, yes.
He knows
yes.
how to work the audience. All right. Well, Michael Medved is basically agreeing with us in his cerebral fashion here. And let me the title of this article in today's Wall Street Journal is The GOP's Strong Conservative Electoral Fantasy. And he basically gives a lesson in politics. And let me just read the first and last couple of paragraphs, and I'll just give you the sort of the synopsis of the middle portion is all to back up his argument, which he presents. Against all logic, some prominent conservatives continue to promote the absurd proposition that right-wing candidates who fail to win over GOP voters in Republican primaries would magically succeed on November ballots. This assumption enables them to retain a naive faith in the claim that true conservatives, who can't mobilize their own base to win nominations, will somehow triumph in general elections by drawing support from moderates and liberals. Pretty much the rest of the article, he provides evidence to support
sure.
that. What he's saying is basically, if you're a guy like Ted Cruz and you're going to be this puritanistic conservative, you're more likely to fail than someone else.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let me just read the last...
You're appealing to too small of a niche.
And what he says is, that's not what works. Okay, like I said, the bulk of his editorialist here is to provide evidence as to why that does not work. Let me tell you now what he says does work, and see if this doesn't sound remotely...
A little familiar.
Yeah, all right. I'm going to go now to the last two paragraphs of his article. Americans vote for talented politicians with winning personalities, and they display no long-standing ideological voting pattern. They embrace charismatic candidates, whether conservative like Reagan, compassionate conservative like Bush II, moderate like Ike, neoliberal like Clinton, or progressive like Obama. In other words, he's saying that the guy with the strongest personality that can get up there and work the crowd the best is who is going to win.
Despite ideology.
Exactly. And let me read the last paragraph. This historical record suggests that a gifted, powerfully persuasive conservative like Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, Bobby Jindal, or Chris Christie, I notice he named basically all establishment conservatives,
yes,
could plausibly win in 2016, just as a dull, inauthentic moderate would probably lose. Recent experience reaffirms the fact that the American people don't automatically award certain victory or inevitable defeat based on ideological outlook, despite cherished conservative legends to the contrary. So,
well, you know what kind of backs that up, Chris, was the election with Bush and Gore. I mean, let's face it, it wasn't like the country was all for one guy or the other, and neither one of these guys had super strong personalities. It was just that Gore's was so bad.
Exactly, and George Bush had a little bit better one.
He was a lot more likable. His likability numbers always were higher.
That's right. But once again, if you look at Barack Obama versus McCain and Romney, which of those three works the crowd the best? Which of those three understands exactly what Michael Medved is saying? Barack Hussein Obama Obama Jarrett. That's why Barack Hussein Obama Obama Jarrett won election to the United States presidency twice. He understands the political, professional, wrestling side of politics. And if the Republicans don't understand that, Michael Medved's right. They're going to get whooped again and again and again.
Well, plus, he did have the bully media on his side, yeah, there to actually go out of their way to make the other guy look ugly.
Right. And that doesn't mean you can't be a true conservative like Ronald Reagan, but it means you got to understand, baby. You got to work the crowd if you intend to win.
Well, absolutely. And actually, folks, we'll be coming back here in just a couple of minutes. This is only round one of a four-round combative little tete-a-tete here with the American adversary. You like that tete-a-tete?
Yeah. Go Michael Medved.
Yes.
He's agreeing with the American adversaries.
He better, by golly. Where are the American adversaries? Do not panic. We will be back.
This is Marilee from Vacation Travel Planners, bringing you the travel deals of the week, like Bahama Cruises from $199 per person. Book the new Norwegian getaway and receive $100 onboard credit.
Oh, yeah.
MSC's Divina is also coming to Miami. Rates start at $499 per person. Princess is offering balcony upgrades, plus $100 onboard credit on other exotic destinations like Australia and South America. Disney Cruise Line has specials on the Disney Magic. Call for details. Sandals and Beaches Resorts are offering up to 65% off. Plus, military and firefighters receive an additional 10% off. Give us a call at 321-251-4777. That's 321-251-4777. Or visit us at vacationtravelplanners.com. Keep listening for new travel specials every week. Bon voyage.
Yo, it's me. It's me. It's DDP.
Yo, it's me. DDP. Diamond Dallas Page. The king of Otter Big. The master of the diamond cutter. The three-time world champion. And you're listening to the American Adversary Drive Time. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. Bye!
That's right. You know what else is a good thing bad is that DDP yoga. It will really get you back into shape in a let's say just at your own speed. So give it a try. DDPyoga.com. Give it a try. DDPyoga.com. Okay. I'd like to now introduce our guest tonight. He's been on our show before. He's a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. He blogs. His blog site is called Letters from the Capitol. He's also the author of Sleepwalking with the Bomb, which is basically about the history of the nuclear weapon. And furthermore, he's also a graduate of the U. That's right, the University of Miami. And I love college football, and the season's getting ready to start. So let's start our conversation tonight with John Wallstetter. Welcome back to the show tonight, John. Thanks once again for being with us.
It's great to be with you and your audience again.
Oh, thank you. The pleasure is ours, I can assure you. So the University of Miami going to do good this year on the gridiron? It seems like they've got a pretty good team going down there.
I must confess that I have been remiss in following college football. I remember I followed about a generation ago. They had all those really good teams. But
yeah.
I I'm afraid I'm a very poor source on that one.
Okay. All right. We'll go you. All right. Well, John, there's several things I want to talk to you about tonight. And one of the things we had actually originally booked you for, I want to talk about it first and then and get into the other things. But, for instance, I want to talk to you about Iran and their activity in developing the nuclear weapon. I want to talk to you about the embassy closings and, in particular, about Benghazi. Yeah. But you also had written an article recently about the stop-and-frisk policy up in New York.
Yes.
And I understand that it's a pretty big issue in the mayoral campaign up there right now. And I have to admit that I don't know enough to know about it, whether I like it or don't like it. So basically, can you give us a brief synopsis of what it is and why you think that it's an effective policy and should be kept?
Yes, stop-and-frisk. Has been a constitutional policy since the 1968 Supreme Court decision, Terry versus Ohio. Even without a warrant, which is normally required for Fourth Amendment search and seizure, and even without evidence for probable cause for arrest, it's based upon a perceived threat either to the police officer or to other members of the community. And it has been constitutional since then. In New York now, all of the Democratic candidates are flatly opposed to it. Rudy Giuliani brought the policy into New York, and in his 8 years as mayor, he had a 66% drop in murders, overall violent crime rate drop of 56%, motor vehicle theft down 73%, robbery 67%, aggravated assault down 28%. And in Rudy plus Bloomberg's terms, and Bloomberg uses it also, there were an average of 1,400 fewer New Yorkers killed a year over the 19 years. So it's been a huge success. Ray Kelly, who is not only the best police chief probably that New York has ever had, he may be the best police chief any country, any city has ever had, has had a stellar turn under Bloomberg. Of 11 years, this is his 12th, and he was for 1 year also for Dinkins. Kelly says this is essential. There are a lot fewer people being killed because of it, and a lot of people in high crime neighborhoods who don't have the community leaders' ears tell the cops that, you know, they want to be protected. They want bad people being taken off the street. It's also the most effective form of gun control. Because unlike a lot of gun control measures, it targets people you want to take guns away from. So it's a very effective measure. It's considered one of the essentials of good crime fighting. And it won't be the only Giuliani-Bloomberg policy that the next mayor of New York, unless there's a surprise and a Republican wins, which is thought unlikely, it won't be the only one they jettison.
It would be entirely up to the mayor's discretion whether this program continued or not?
Well, the city council actually has passed a law. They enact laws, but they could be vetoed by the mayor, passed the law ending stop and frisk. I haven't seen whether Bloomberg has whether it's made it to his desk yet or not. But in any event, if they get a Democratic mayor, it's going to go by the wayside, barring a miracle.
Well, some of the complaints about it that I've heard are, first of all, civil libertarians, don't like the idea of the police just being able to stop anybody. Are there any criteria that the police are going by, or do they just basically randomly pick people? And two, there are some who feel like that it focuses too much on minorities. In other words, it's a form of racial profiling. How would you respond?
Let's take the second one first.
Okay.
The second one is that if you go by the percentage of the population, blacks are 23% of New York's population. I think there's something like 50% of the stops or something. But they commit 80% of the murders and about two-thirds of the violent felonies. So if you use the yardstick of the population, yes, they are signaled out, but that's not the correct one to use. You use their share of the crimes. It's like in terrorists, if 90% of them are Mideastern origin, a good profile should remove mostly, people from the high-threat groups.
Now, but we're not supposed to do that.
Well, but, yeah, of course, the thing is, of course, what's forgotten is that the victims overwhelmingly are also, of these people, are also black. The Chicago, the epidemic they have there now, is blacks shooting blacks. It's tragic. Now, the other thing about random, no. Police officers learn the behavioral cues. They can tell the difference between somebody after they've been on the street who is looking at a jewelry store window, just admiring what's in there, and somebody who might be casing the place. They learn how to do this. So, you know, dress has something to do with it. If you have a tuxedo, you're less likely to be stopped than if you're wearing a hoodie. If you're a skinhead in white, you're more likely to get a look over than if you're someone who's a businessman. These are experience cues, and it has worked. Again, this is, sure, yeah, they do. Obviously, they stop people who are not, you know, from time to time. I don't have any percentages. But if you end the practice, you're going to have more people in those neighborhoods going around with guns, and many of the people they stop have criminal records, and this is a way to make the community much safer. So if they're not doing it at random. They're not doing it racially, stopping people, you know, walking while black. They're not doing that. But they are it's in neighborhoods like that, high crime neighborhoods,
right.
More people are walking around with guns.
Let me ask you this, John. You know, Lair sort of hit the nail on the head. You know, this is not politically correct, and I think that's what we're talking about here. A program is effective, but not politically correct. But are there any other cities that are trying this as well, or is New York the lone city?
Oh, no. Stop and Frisk is implemented widely, and there were a whole bunch of people who were high-ranking under Giuliani, one former police chief, Bratton, who went to L.A., and a whole bunch of others who went to cities like Miami, Philadelphia, and others.
Are they seeing similar
policies?
Are they seeing similar drops in the crime rate?
They've had drops in the crime rate. There has been in the last 20 years an overall drop in the crime rate nationally.
Correct.
In most places, but Giuliani and Bloomberg's rate was much steeper than most.
Okay.
So these methods work.
All right, well, listen, John, thanks for that. When we come back, I want to talk to you about Iran and their development of the nuclear weapon and then these embassies and the terrorist threat. So, ladies and gentlemen, stick around. When we come back, we'll be talking more with John Wohlstetter, and you can join us at 407-774-8255.
That's right. He is the author of Sleepwalking with the Bomb, and we'll be right back.
Back from the dressing room to re-stretch their tights, here are the champions of political professional wrestling, the American Adversary.
Okay, folks, welcome back to the show. That's right, the American Adversary's Drive Time. Christopher Hart, Lair Adams live with you in the studio this afternoon. 407-774-8255 is the number. We have author and blogger and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, John Wohlstetter, on the line with us, and our executive producer, Nostra Dennis, is going to join in as well. And we welcome you to call and join in if you have any questions or comments. John, Iran just got their new president sworn in the other day, and there's a bit of optimism. There may be a window here of opportunity to make some headway on Iran's nuclear weapon program. However, there are some troubling news that has just come out this week, and that is that Iran could be producing weapons-grade plutonium by next summer, these news reports say, and using a different technology that would be easier for us to attack. So what's going on here? Are they changing their approach to speed up the development of nuclear weapons, and is that going to make them more vulnerable, or is this a very ominous development?
Well, it's an ominous development. This is another road to Rome, so to speak, to nuclear Rome. The thing is, the uranium enrichment plants, the two primary ones, are buried. Natanz is buried, the largest is buried about 70 feet down, and Al-Fordow is buried 200, about 70 meters down. So they're much harder to hit, especially the Al-Fordow. They would enrich uranium, which is a long and arduous process, to produce material for your uranium bomb, fuel for a uranium bomb. The other is there is an Arak nuclear plant, a reactor that they want to run. And when they run that reactor, a nuclear reactor produces plutonium as a byproduct. And that is easier to separate out. You use chemical rather than isotopic separation, although it's very hazardous to handle. And then they would have fuel for a plutonium bomb, which takes less material to create a bomb, although it is trickier to detonate. But that facility, just like the Bushehr facility the Russians built for the Iranians, that is sitting on the surface. The only thing is that once the reactor has nuclear material in it, you don't want to bomb it because it would blow nuclear material all over the place.
And
so they're watching the loading of the reactor. If they think it's being loaded with nuclear material, they'll do what they did with Saddam.
You think that that's going to happen? Because you're right. This is in the northwestern city of Iraq.
Yeah.
It is a nuclear, nuclear energy facility. And you're absolutely right that this thing would be vulnerable to attack. Why would they do that? Is this just part of their overall strategy to say that all they really want is peaceful nuclear energy?
Well, I think that part of it is because there are surface facilities and they're located near populated areas, there's more likely to be collateral damage.
Right.
Whereas if you hit a sunken facility, the Israelis won't use a weapon that will blow up everything. If you're deep down in Al-Fordow or something, it takes a huge explosion to hurt anybody on the surface. But it really comes down to this. I'm not sure Bibi can keep his cabinet together to go for a strike. Israel is under immense pressure from the United States. This unfortunate decision to release 104 Palestinian terrorists was directly the result of U.S. pressure, hugely unpopular in Israel. So I'm not sure that Bibi can hold that together. That's the real question.
Well, actually, we have a regular on our show, Abe Katzman, who reports in to us from Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And he just wrote an article, and he's just speculating and hoping. But he is speculating that perhaps the trade-off was, we'll release these terrorists if you support us in a strike on Iran. Do you think that that's false hope?
I think it's possible that Obama's people said that. I don't believe they would honor the commitment.
And that's a question that Larry asked of Abe last night. How can you trust Obama even if he does promise something like that?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. And
so
I don't
so this is very troubling development then.
Yes, it is.
John, let me ask you a question. Larry Adams here. I grew up in the 60s. I remember getting under my desk. I remember the drills, people building the bomb shelters and things like that. And we were totally frightened of the bomb. And then that fear seemed to sort of go away. But after 9/11 and after these other developments, it seems like people are worried more than ever today.
Well, it's a different kind of fear. In those days, the fear was of an all-out nuclear war. I grew up in the 50s and early 60s, and we used to go... I remember not going under the desk, but going down to the basement in the school. But the thing there was of an all-out nuclear exchange of some sort, or with the Soviet Union. Today, and of course we came very close during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but today you're dealing with people, the mullahs in Iran, and of course that loon in North Korea, who we really, let alone if in Pakistan there's a change to the Islamists, where we can't have any confidence that they could be deterred. And I think that's the source of the nervousness, although I'm not sure a large share of the public with all that's been going on has been paying a lot of attention recently.
Yeah, I would be of the thought of that, too. But with Iran, you know, having connections to terrorist organizations and Hezbollah and things like that, just developing the weapon and then passing it along to these other groups is, you know, the real fear, I believe, here.
Sure.
Well, I think the real fear is a little bit different because it's not easy for those terror groups to operate logistically and transport the thing over to the United States. We're much better at looking for these things than we were 10 years ago. I think probably right now the number one fear, which the North Koreans have had ships in the Gulf, is if they fire, they can even use a relatively short-range missile or medium-range missile, fire it off
the deck of a freighter.
A freighter,
yeah.
Which then, although they won't tell the crew this, would be scuttled in deep water. And if they detonated high altitude over the United States, they could issue some powerful electromagnetic pulses that could seriously damage our electric grid, which would be a catastrophe. And they could even, at lower altitudes with a short-range missile, detonate it over the East Coast and damage up to 70% in a worst case of our overall capacity. So I think that may be more the worry now among people who will follow these things.
Okay, John, let me bring in our producer, Nostra Dennis, into this conversation. Dennis, any questions along these lines before we move it to the embassy closings in Benghazi?
Yeah, actually, with your permission, I'd like to backtrack to what we were talking about before the break, because I looked at a story today about something I didn't hear in the press. Did you hear about the president signing an executive order, John, called the African American Education Initiative? No. Okay, apparently he signed this back on the 26th. And what it says, basically it gives a green light for black students to misbehave in public schools. It's an executive order. It's not a bill. It calls on schools to reduce the number of disciplinary actions taken against black students and not to rely on methods that result in disparate use of disciplinary tools. In other words, if your school is 20% black, then 20% of the students you suspend must be black, no more. Is that similar to what you were talking about the frisk and search regulation?
Well, it is the same basic idea, which is that you're trying to look at what the profile is and what these people want to do is try and go by the share of the population, not the share of the offenses. Mm-hmm. So that's really, that's the kind of thing. I'm looking at this thing online now. But it's too long for me to quickly read and respond to. But if that's a fair summary, and I'm not suggesting it isn't, that is the same kind of thinking, because it's their share of the offenders and not their share of the population that should determine whether you see something being applied discriminatorily.
And
same flawed logic, yeah.
And don't we kind of, doesn't this administration kind of do the same thing when it comes to terrorism?
Well, it does it with just about everything. This is what the quota crowd does.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're looking at numbers, not reality. John, let's talk about the embassy closings. Do you think that there's a lot of skepticism out there. You know, I take it for its face value that this is a credible threat. Do you think it is? And why is it the administration is reacting so with this threat?
Well, I have to assume it is, because the administration wouldn't take so extreme a measure if they didn't think it was credible. It is possible that the chatter, because they know they're being monitored, is deliberately to scare us into doing this, and they may decide to do this periodically. But they are the ones who are looking at the intelligence, and in this case, I don't doubt their sincerity on that, but I think that's only one part of it. I think they're, as I wrote in my blog letter from the Capitol today, that they're also concerned about they can't take a chance in getting caught with another Benghazi, and that our failure to respond to the attack may be behind their doing this. We may have less intelligence because we have ceased collecting information by certain ways of interrogating detainees. And, of course, in releasing this thing, we compromise intel sources. So I think it basically makes us look weaker, and it leaves us vulnerable to more things like this. September 11th is coming up, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and the thought of, that this just might be a hoax, so to speak, perpetrated by terrorists. But, you know, that thought had crossed our mind as well. And look at what we're doing. I mean, do you think that there would have been another response that wouldn't have given us the appearance of tucking our tail and run, so to speak?
Well, I think we're already caught out on this because we don't seem to be in touch with what's going on out there in the way that perhaps we once were. Again, I'm not questioning their sincerity. I don't think they would fake it on this side. I don't trust them at a lot of things, the IRS, the death panels, and all the rest of that. But I do think that the warning is sincere. But I think that the mistakes the administration has made and its diminished standing in the Middle East as a result made this kind of thing more likely. They may be playing us, or it may be real, and it could be hard to tell just by looking at chatter. If you don't have ground sources in there that are giving you this, and maybe they do it. If they do, we shouldn't know. But I don't question the sincerity of what they're doing. I want to make that clear, even though I think their policies created a situation where this is more likely.
Do you think that the drone program is being relied on too much, and that going in and actually capturing some of these guys and trying to get some intelligence from them has not been utilized enough by this administration?
Well, I think that it's very difficult to capture people who are in very remote areas. So in a lot of cases, a capture operation may not be feasible, and it carries its own risk of leaving hostages, et cetera. But I do think that there are, they certainly are not encouraging keeping detainees when our troops gather them in the field, and they've been encouraged to kill rather than capture. And what that leads to over a long period of time is, as your intel grows stale, it's not replaced. And I'm hearing from some of the people I talk to on intelligence that that's what's happening. Our intelligence reliability is going down.
John, after 5 years of Obama, what is your take on how the rest of the world views us?
Well, there's no question in my mind that our standing is greatly diminished. And his primary goal of achieving a connection with the Muslim world, which in his speech at Cairo he talked about how he wanted to reach out, has been a total failure. He is held in contempt. In Egypt, of course, the Islamists can't stand him, even though he supported the Muslim Brotherhood, because now he's holding back. And, of course, the secular liberals over there are scornful of him as well.
Yeah.
In Syria, his name is Mud. He is in Iraq. He walked away from a situation which we kept stable, and you have the specter of a civil war there. He's in retreat, and frankly, I don't think he even has he has diminished credibility even with our allies. It's a very serious situation.
Yeah, as I said on last night's show with Abe Katzman, that's what he gets for leading with his behind,
yeah,
so to speak. Nostradamus, real quickly, what's the latest on Benghazi that you were checking out today, please, sir?
Well, this is something that the big guy was talking about in his show today, but it's from a place called conservativereport.org that is very often right on things. It's not one of those crackpot websites. Confidential sources close to the website have confirmed that Valerie Jarrett was the key decision maker for the administration on the night of 9/11. This means two things. The first thing that's very, very troubling is it says in this report that they had the equipment and the manpower ready to come in and rescue the ambassador and his staff. The outcome would have been two SEALs still alive and a mess of dead terrorists. They refused to do that. Apparently, Valerie Jarrett is the one who issued that refusal. Second thing is that the order of cross-border authority was denied, and that was done by Valerie Jarrett. Valerie Jarrett was not elected by anybody.
Well, do we know if she was delivering the president's decision? Is she? Let me go to John. John,
right,
is that?
Let me approach this obliquely.
Yes, please.
Yeah. It is quite clear that Valerie Jarrett is a major decision maker on policy matters, although she has no policy expertise whatsoever. She apparently is the most trusted advisor close to the president.
Right.
The second thing is, we now know there were several dozen CIA operatives on the ground that night. So,
on the ground in Benghazi,
yes,
sir?
That's right. And they are being pressured to clam up. They've been forced to sign non-disclosure agreements. And why would they be doing this? If the story was we did everything they could, they would have the incentive to have these people come out and tell their story. And I think I've also heard of credible statements about help being, for example, at Sigonella Air Force Base an hour's flight away. And we don't know because people are not talking, but it certainly bears further looking into.
Well,
there are only two people who know who issued that cross-border authority, and one of them was asleep getting his beauty rest for the following day.
Well, you know, it seems to me, though, John, this would actually be more of a reason for Hillary Clinton to go along with this, because this makes her a little bit better if they could pin this on Valerie.
She doesn't look so good. I mean, she distanced herself from, she let Susan Rice take the fall. But when she said, what difference does it make, four people are dead? It makes all the difference in the world. Because
sure,
if it's a random attack, it's not a failure of intelligence. It wasn't, because they were using mortars and other equipment that you don't just show up with randomly. It was an organized attack. So she doesn't look very good on that at all. As far as Obama, it's unthinkable that any other president would have walked away for the evening after handing out whatever orders. This just, he would have been, any other president, I think, even Democrats, would have been in that situation room.
I know, John, that's what perplexes me. You would think just out of sheer curiosity and wanting to know what was going on, he would be in there or constantly on the telephone getting updates. He just seemed like he just didn't care.
Well, you know, he is very detached about certain things, and unfortunately we're left basically with guesswork. To me, it doesn't matter what his reason was. When you have a situation like this, George Bush would have been, either one would have been in that situation.
Sure.
Bill Clinton would have been there.
Yep.
Ronald Reagan would have been there. Jimmy Carter would have been there.
Yeah, he would.
And he was not, and there's no excuse for that. This is AWOL at a time when no president should be.
All right.
That's what it was.
All right, John, we're going to have to leave it there tonight, but I want to get you back on once again in the future. And once again, your blog site?
Letter from the Capitol.
Letter from the Capitol. So go there and read John's work, and as you can tell, he knows what he's talking about. So, John, we'll talk to you in the near future, sir. Thank you very much.
Thanks, gentlemen, and thanks to your audience for tuning in.
All right. Thank you, sir. We appreciate that.
Definitely, John. Thank you. Folks, we are the American Adversaries, and we're coming back for a very short segment, but don't you worry. It will be totally worth it.
The Bad Man of World Championship Wrestling, and I'm here to tell you, listen to the American Adversaries. They may be some bad men, but they're great guys.
That's right, folks. American Adversaries are here, and Johnny B. Badd, the guy you just heard on there, he will be here tomorrow, a special guest in studio. And right now, if you'd like to call in 407-774-8255, we're going to actually go to Brad, and he wants to talk about something Oprah said about Trayvon Martin, I believe. Is that correct, Brad?
Oh, yes. I was actually, my jaw dropped to the floor. I mean, because obviously Oprah Winfrey is not known as a very radicalized...
Okay. Let me back up, because, Brad, we're real short on time. Basically, Oprah Winfrey has likened to Trayvon Martin being killed to Emmett Till and what happened to Emmett Till. And Emmett Till was tracked down. He was tortured. It was a whole lot different. So, real quickly, your thought on it.
Well, my thought is that if she's indicative of the mainstream of African-American thinking, that's scary, because you guys remember when I segued a while back into how African-Americans view Elvis Presley, and it's in a very hateful, racist way. So my thinking is, if she's mainstream like this, and this really radicalized thinking, because there's no facts to support her, obviously they're nothing like each other, the Emmett Till and Trayvon.
Well, I suspect
that should give people pause.
Yeah, I thank you, Brad. I appreciate your call. I just have to let you go because we're all out of time. But I suspect she doesn't know the facts of the case. It's most likely she doesn't know what she's talking about, and that's really the bottom line.
She's getting him from Al Sharpton, and
that's absolutely right. Nostradamus, your thoughts on it, real quick, and then I have to let you go because we're just about out of time.
Yes, I spell Obama with a zero at the front, and I spell Oprah the same way. I don't listen to what she says.
Doesn't pay to, does it?
The O is an empty letter.
All right. Thank you, Nostradamus. We'll talk to you tomorrow night.
See ya.
We appreciate it. And, folks, in the studio we have with us right now Marshall Polston, who does a show live here every Saturday afternoon from 2 to 3 o'clock on 660 AM. Marshall, welcome to the show today.
Well, thanks so much, guys, for having me on. I really appreciate it. I'm so glad to be here. And let me tell you what. I'm really, really disappointed about what's happening in our communities because of people like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson.
Yeah,
well, I mean, what we've got going on now is division and divisiveness, and that's what liberals and progressives like to do, because they know if they can divide us, we will not be able to unite as Americans and as one country to combat what they're doing to us and what they're changing, and they're changing our values and what the founders set up here, and that's not right.
Marshall, let me ask you this. What does boycotting Florida, how does that help black people here in Florida?
It doesn't help black people here in Florida, especially when there's not a problem to begin with. And I think, I believe Governor Rick Scott even, was it that he told Jesse Jackson to apologize and Al Sharpton? So I think that was warranted, and they shouldn't be.
If I'm Rick Scott, though, I'm not holding my breath waiting for that apology.
No way.
You know, we talked about this actually on our Sunday night show. There is some encouraging things happening in Sanford, and I'm talking specifically about the Sanford Declaration, where these pastors have gotten together, and they're working through this, and my goal is to see forgiveness come to the forefront, that for the black community in particular to move forward, they're going to have to find forgiveness in their heart and be able to put past transgressions behind them. They cannot continue to go down the same road following Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, regurgitating all these old wounds and pouring salt in, and you know, reopening all these old wounds and pouring salt in them. It's just not going to work. Forgiveness is the way.
And I think one politician, just real quick, what we've seen in the past year or two is Albert Gilroy. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's absolutely phenomenal. He really has done a great job of getting the black community involved in Republican politics and having them realize, hey, you know, Republicans aren't racist, sexist, homophobes. They're really out there to help everyone get jobs, to help the economy get going, and to make sure that everybody has the most freedom and liberty possible.
Where's he from?
I believe he's from Louisiana.
You know, the best thing about Marshall Polston, folks, is he's so young. He's got his whole future ahead of him. You know, Larry and I, we're going to be dead and gone long before this. He's still going to be talking on the radio.
Speak for yourself.
But Marshall Polston does a great show every Saturday afternoon. He's live right here on 660 AM from 2 to 3 o'clock, except actually this Saturday you've taped your show because you have another obligation.
That's right. But we're going to be back next Saturday with Congressman Daniel Webster, so do not miss that.
All right.
It's going to be awesome.
Excellent. He gets great guests, too. I tell you what. So don't forget Marshall Polston live every Saturday from 2 to 3 o'clock.
Yep.
Hey, we've had Daniel Webster on our show, too. You're going to enjoy that. He's a great guy. Folks, we are the American Adversaries. We've done it for this evening. However, we will be back tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Don't you dare miss it. Johnny B. Badd is going to be in studio.
All right, folks. Night, everybody.
News Talk.